July 7th, 1982, Margaret Benston speaks on women and automation.
Okay, needing no introduction. For those of you who don't sort of have it at the tip of your fingers, I teach in computing science and women's studies here at Simon Fraser. I used to teach in chemistry and computing and switched over. And right at the moment, I'm interested in questions of women in technology and women in science. And what I want to talk about today is something fairly generally about the relationship between women and machines in work, maybe with a subtitle called The Automation of Automation, which we'll get to. Now let me, so there aren't any surprises as to the conclusions, I won't keep you in suspense about the conclusions I'm going to come to. I'll give them to you right at the beginning, and then the rest of the talk will be the documentation. The relationship between women and machines, as you might have noticed, isn't a particularly comfortable one. And particularly the growth of industrial production in Europe and North America has meant, I think, an increasing distance between women and the tools that they work with, both in designing and controlling those tools. Whether women work in the home or outside the home, the work is done with increasingly sophisticated technology and with machines that require specialized training to understand, much less design and build. This is true for everybody in the workplace, but I think it's a specific problem for women, given the gender differentiation, given the sexual division of labor, which says that machines are an area outside of women's expertise. Technology is perceived as a male realm. One of the solutions to this situation is getting a fair amount of public play these days, particularly with the automation that I'll come to, the automation of women's work in the office. One of the strategies is that women should reclaim their rightful place in technology, that they should get training in the sciences, they should get training in computing science, and simply join in to this. If jobs are being lost in offices, women should get jobs as programmers, retrain themselves, get jobs as programmers. This is a possible strategy for a few people, I think. And it might even be a necessary step in terms of changing the world. But I don't think that it's a sufficient strategy. I don't think in any sense that this is an adequate response. This is the major response, by the way, of the Canadian government to technological change, is training and retraining. Get yourself technical training in some way. I don't think it's an adequate response, first of all, because it doesn't deal with the basic question of who controls the technology, of what it's used for, of where it comes from, why it's introduced into work, and a whole range of problems around the social function of technology. That's a much more abstract kind of thing than the second point, which is that there simply aren't going to be enough jobs to make that a viable. And that's the second point is mostly what this talk is about, is what automation is doing to jobs and where it comes from, why the technology is introduced, and why there aren't going to be adequate jobs in technology for all the people who are displaced by the automation that's going on. And it's a kind of an interesting story, I think. Part of it is, if you look around in the society, one of the keynotes of this, is that the industrial base is increasingly highly sophisticated, highly technological, dependent on a high level of expertise to function. The people who operate that system are increasingly what's called de-skilled. But the people who actually operate the machines have, as I said at the beginning, a much greater distance from the machines and much less control or expertise over their work, over the machines that they work with, than they even had 50 years ago when the machines were less complicated. Somebody operating a word processor is more removed, I claim, from that tool than from a typewriter. And So as the industrial base gets more complicated and requires more expertise to develop and run, the paradox is that the mass of people who work in that system have fewer and fewer skills. There are a few people who are increasingly highly skilled, who build, design, and design these sorts of things. These are the jobs that women are urged to get into. You can be the movers and takers in technology. But the trend is clear that most jobs will involve less technical skill than more. And for women's jobs, this is really clear, I think. To see where, well, let me give some statistics then. The new wave of automation of technology is based on microelectronics, on computer technology. And one of the major places where that's affecting work, as I say, is in offices. Communications, filing, information handling of all kinds are being increasingly supported by microelectronic technology. And the predictions are that the automation of office work will lead to a major loss of office jobs in the next decade, and further a de-skilling of the office jobs that remain. Unemployment among clerical workers was 7% in 1979, and depending on your scenarios for the rate of office automation, the unemployment rate in 1990 will almost certainly be double, at least double that, and maybe as high as 40%. In the next 8 years, that something like four out of 10 office workers might lose their jobs. To understand the factors that are going on in automation, it's interesting to, and the concept of de-skilling, I think it's interesting to go back to the very first introduction of automated machinery in the Industrial Revolution, and in fact to take a look at what pre-industrial production was like, because these are themes that run all the way through. Pre-industrial production, as you probably all know when you think about it, involved artisans who worked in households, controlled their own tools, controlled their own work process, and made the goods from start to finish. That there wasn't a division of labor, there might have been a division of labor within the household in terms of production, but it was done in a very integrated fashion. And it was done under the control of the people who did it. This is your original non-alienated labor. If any of you have read William Morris, this is the golden age that he harks back to about how work ought to be done. Probably not as idealized as he says, but still a very distinctive production style. Women, by the way, were a crucial part of production in this style. They managed household tasks. They also took a sufficient part in production that, although men were the guild members and the master craftsmen, if the men died, the women ordinarily took over their membership in the guild and took over production because they had all the skills. The first step toward industrialization and toward modern industrial techniques was what's called the putting out system. And this involved the direct involvement of entrepreneurs with production. One of the marks that's usually given of this is that they introduced spinning jennies and machinery, sort of the first high-tech machinery into production to ease bottlenecks, to raise productivity in necessary points. For this discussion, this isn't the important thing that happened with putting out industry. What happened was a change in the organization of production. Because what the entrepreneurs did is that they owned the tools and the raw materials, and they divided production up into its various tasks. First of all, in textiles, that's where it happened at the very first. They divided cloth manufacture up into carding, spinning, weaving, finishing, dyeing, the various sorts of tasks, and parceled them out to different groups of people. And it's the beginning of the industrial division of labor, an absolutely crucial step, so that somebody now might know only spinning, and somebody now might know only weaving. The division of labor decreased, but it didn't totally eliminate the knowledge and the control that people had over work. They still, within their area, were the people who knew how to do it and knew what they did. And the entrepreneurs were still dependent on workers for detailed expertise within the given task. The guy who parceled out the yarn for spinning did not know how to operate a spinning wheel. And if the spinster told him that she could only produce X number of tanks of yarn a day, then that was something he had to accept. This division of labor was crucial, though, to the way that this whole system worked. And it made possible the Industrial Revolution. Because the factory system is not just the introduction of machinery, of power machinery. The factory system is based on division of labor. And that's absolutely crucial. Such division of labor was, and the machinery, were important for a number of reasons. In the first place, they gave a direct gain in productivity. Productivity increased, first of all, because machinery multiplied power. Power machinery meant you were no longer dependent on human muscle power. But the change in organization of production increased productivity by itself. It's the beginning of mass production techniques. Adam Smith, for those of you who've delved into his stuff, has got a really well-known example of the manufacture of pins. And instead of having an artisan hustle that manufactured straight pins, you had a factory that divided it down into something like 27 different processes. And each process was done by a different person, straightening the wire, cutting the wire, beveling the edges, so on and so on. And essentially, the same idea as assembly line technique. Somebody standing there doing one repetitive task over and over again. If you want an example from women's work, you can consider making bread. Instead of somebody who simply knows how to make bread, you analyze the work and you break it up into someone who measures the ingredients, someone who mixes the dough, somebody who operates a kneading machine, somebody who cuts the dough in pieces, somebody who shapes it for the loaf, somebody who puts it in the oven. And you get an increase in productivity from the employer's point of view because the tasks can simply be done faster at each station. And less skill is required for each single one of these tasks. You no longer need to know how to bake bread, only how to mix it if you're a mixer. And you don't have to know what kneading, you know, the properly kneaded product feels like at the end if you're the person who just mixes the ingredients. With the decrease in skill made possible by this came a decrease in wages. You pay people less because they're skilled less. And this is the major advantage that Adam Smith argued for division of labor, that you increase productivity directly, you decrease skills, and therefore allow lowering of wages. Exactly these same arguments, by the way, were made by Charles Babbage, who's better known as the man who invented the modern computer 100 years before anybody else. And computers essentially depend on division of labor also. I'll come back to that. Now, if you're going to introduce a more detailed division of labor, and you're a boss, an entrepreneur, you have to, or a manufacturer, you have to understand all parts of the productive process much better. Right? If you're going to divide spinning up, as was done, into various processes, you have to understand, as well as the spinsters do, how spinning is done. So workers didn't have a monopoly on the knowledge needed for production as industrialization increased. And this made possible a second kind of increase in productivity. And this involved being able to control the workers, being able to exert control over management performance because now, or over worker performance, because now management understands how things are done against how they could be done. As long as management doesn't have this control, you have the situation where the workers in the bread factory can tell management, look, we can't speed up production because you've got to knead the bread 15 minutes. Right? It's just impossible to do it shorter. And if the technical expertise isn't available in the office, there's no response. This is, of course, a management nightmare, being at the mercy of your workers. And it led to a very strong tendency to try and understand the very basic details of production, and for knowledge of those details to move into the office, and for the workers to simply be told what their one routine task ought to be. This was formalized and made theoretical by Taylor around the turn of the century with his theories of scientific management. These are the principles by which all modern industrial workplaces, be they businesses or manufactories, work these days. They may have dressed them up in modern industrial relations arguments, but the basic principles are the same, sometimes undiluted. The Canadian Post Office is pure Taylorist. They've got a workbook that Taylor could have written. His basic principle was that given a half a chance, workers in any factory, in any job, would, what he called soldier, would loaf on the job. They would conceal from management the rate at which work could be done for their own benefit. And that management's job, therefore, was to understand the most efficient way to accomplish the tasks that had to be done. And at this point, management would be in a position to dictate to workers exactly how the task was to be performed and to dictate the speed at which it could be performed. When we come to office work, these become fairly, and particularly things like word processors, fairly important sorts of principles. So the basic principles of scientific management still around are a strict division between mental and manual labor. Management gets the head part of work. They get the understanding of how the process goes. They get the understanding of the overall flow of work or information or whatever's going on. Manual workers are given only the exact specifications of the work that they do. They are not expected or encouraged to know anything else about production. Work is supposed to be reduced to its absolutely simplest component, the most simplest repetitive task possible to be given to to workers with the least skill needed for that particular task. And third, each of the repetitive tasks was to be timed and analyzed for potential speed and accuracy. And in pure Taylorist shops, these are the time and efficiency experts who come in and measure how long it takes you to move in milliseconds or whatever, how long it takes you to move your hand out here, how long to drop it down, exactly what grasping motion is most efficient to pick something up with, and how long it should take you to do that. Or if you're a telephone operator operating one of the automated systems, exactly what sequence of events are supposed to happen, exactly what words you use, exactly how many calls you can handle in an hour, that sort of thing. So these tasks are timed and analyzed, and then each worker's performance is monitored against these standards. And wherever possible, this is a parenthetical remark, wherever possible, the standards are consistently revised upwards. If workers show they can do something at a certain speed, then you up the quotas or the norm to try for a new one. Now, the point of all this is that none of these reasons for these are all the reasons for the introduction of technology, for possible uses of machines. You reduce the tasks required in production down to these simple repetitive forms, and then it becomes obvious for many of them that either a machine plus an operator or a machine alone can carry out the task. Once you understand exactly what motions are required, right, there's no reason why you can't further automate it. Once you've operated the worker and turned the worker into a hand with exactly understood motions for everything they do, there's no reason at all, if the technology is available, why a machine can't be introduced to do the same thing. And it's on the basis of these productivity needs and on the basis of this need for both increasing production and increasing control over worker performance that automation becomes possible. So on the basis of this knowledge of production, right, of exactly what's required, that it's possible to introduce machinery. So that's the basic process that happened in factory production, sort of production of goods, for about 100 years, the end of the 18th century, the end of the 1700s, up to the beginning of this century, was a continual process of ever more sort of analysis, introduction of division of labor, introduction of machinery, or of assembly line techniques. The assembly line is the culmination of this trend of automation, with the culmination of the assembly line, the Toyota plant in Japan, which requires no workers at all. One of them. There's one that isn't quite fully automated. It has 65 workers a shift, runs three shifts a day, and turns out 1,800 cars a shift. And clearly, if you think about it, it requires an incredibly detailed analysis of what is required for each step in the process of having a manufacturer to allow the introduction of machinery. And this didn't happen overnight. It was a long-term sort of process of ever-expanding division of labor and ever-expanding analysis of how production is done. Okay, one final note about this. One of the clear results of the introduction of high productivity organizational techniques and high productivity machines is that jobs get lost. That's what productivity means, is that fewer people produce more goods. So of necessity, jobs are lost. That's the whole point of the introduction of industrial techniques and particularly of automation. Early on in the introduction of this sort of stuff, people were making dire predictions that the end of the world was coming and there wouldn't be any jobs left for anybody. This didn't happen. It didn't happen either in Europe or North America for a number of reasons. First of all, as you know, the economies expanded tremendously through the 19th century. And while the output of goods, perhaps even the same number of workers kept their jobs and produced enormously enlarged amounts of goods. That's what mass production is about. But the markets increased for these goods at the same time. So that the jobs in manufacturing didn't necessarily contract. There just weren't as many created as you might have expected given earlier industrial techniques. Another thing that happened, though, and a crucially important one, was that new kinds of jobs were created as the economies expanded. And the most important of these were in information handling. The information handling needs of North American and European economies expanded enormously. One of the reasons that I find most interesting being that as you get the separation of head and hand in manufacturing, it means that office functions increase simply in terms of the details of production. The information that used to be in the master craftsman's head about where stuff was along the production line or what was required next or what orders were coming in a small-scale business, all now had to be in the office file. All the orders for raw materials, all the information about what stage production was at, who the orders were going to, even the details about design of the assembly line or everything, worker performance, control of personnel, all that sort of stuff, all now has to be written down, maintained, communicated to people in the office, endless meetings are held, conferences, whatever, memos are written, that kind of thing. That in itself created a vast increase in the information needs of business. Along with that meant all of the needs from the increase in sheer size, right? From the growth of North American markets, from the multinationalization of the world, all the information now about where raw materials are coming from, about government functions, all of the service needs for individuals and their relationship with business and government. All of these required pieces of paper to deal with, required information handling. And enormous numbers of new jobs were created in the information handling areas, which is often called the service area. A lot of other jobs were created in new ones, but this is the one of interest. And this is the area where women found a major area of employment. Many more women were drawn into wage work through this century than had been in wage work before. The early days of clerkdom in offices, the early days of information handling, involved male clerks who did all the office functions, were management trainees usually, working their way up to be junior partners or whatever, and understood the whole flow of business, right, and handled it all. You might even consider them as artisans within this kind of context, because there was much the same flavor about their work. As the information needs expanded, you got simultaneously the introduction of automated equipment, the typewriter, and women into the office, and the beginnings of division of labor. And these tendencies have continued through the century. With exactly the same reasons for the introduction of machinery and division of labor in the office as were important in manufacturing. And increasingly clerical functions, secretarial, whatever you want to call it, clerk functions, to use sort of the English terms as opposed to clerics now, or clerks now, have been analyzed, fragmented, divided, parceled out into different specialties, many of them involving then lower skills, and automated. So that we now have the situation in all kinds of areas where information handling is done by machines. Automatic cash registers, automatic inventory control, the top system in the telephone company, which completely automates long distance calls, essentially completely automates them. The sequence of introduction of these machines is reasonably straightforward. From the typewriter, we get fairly early on the infamous IBM card with mechanical sorting and very early sort of electronic tabulating of data, and moving on to Xerox machines, which are another important area of office automation, to the new microtechnology. A couple of examples of what's happened in these areas. In insurance companies now, policy renewal. This is a specialized function resulting from the total division of labor in the office, or this tendency to division of labor in the office. In insurance companies, you would have a specialty as a clerical worker who is responsible for policy renewal, looking up expiry dates on insurance policies, checking to see if the coverage was right, sort of upping them to take inflation into account, calculating the new premium, writing up the policies, typing them up. That might be done by the typing tool, actually probably would be. Sending out the notices, doing follow-up notices. This is all now done automatically. Every single task in there is now done by computer programs. And those jobs will be completely eliminated in most insurance companies, probably within a couple of years, in the larger insurance companies that are producing. More interesting example is the general secretary. Now, the general secretary maintains some of the flavor of the turn of the century clerk in a lot of offices. That she was responsible for some typing, some shorthand, keeping the files up to date, knowing where information was, particularly knowing the flow of information inside the company, who was supposed to know what when, right? Making sure that information got to the right people, knowing who her boss was supposed to talk to about what. A lot of just general knowledge about general things in the company that is somewhat anomalous and was a holdout against the general trend to office automation. In some ways was, I've read a couple books that talk about it as a kind of status symbol left over from older sort of days, counter to the trend of division of labor and automation in the office. But a more, I think, telling argument for it was given by the Harvard Business Review a few years ago, where someone was discussing the Peter Principle. You know about the Peter Principle? That people tend to rise to the level of their incompetence in executive jobs? And so, and this is a kind of a human interest article, semi-facetious in Harvard Business Review. They said, okay, suppose this is true, and it's got a ring of truth to it. They said, you know, we sort of instinctively recognize this. This has got a large component of truth to it. Assuming it's true, how do businesses function at all, since a large number of their executive positions are staffed by people who can't do the job? I mean, that's the consequence of this principle, right? The answer was, of course, the secretary. Right, the secretary is there to maintain the flow of information and decision-making in the office, which is a kind of an interesting thought. This, whether or not this is true, I mean, whatever you think of this as a piece of social analysis, even this bastion of a slightly non-alienated work in the office seems to be crumbling. And the pressure on secretarial functions, particularly in large businesses, and these are on average, there are lots of places where this doesn't apply, particularly small businesses, but the pressure on secretarial jobs in large offices has been clear for a number of years. the division of those functions into typing pools, into filing clerks, receptionists, a kind of general secretary for a number of executives who will keep track of appointments and remind them about their wife's birthday and do all those office wife sorts of functions. But with a clear fragmentation and de-skilling of the jobs that result, almost no one learns shorthand these days, right? Because dictation machines and various sorts of automation have taken away that function from secretaries.